Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Today on Edgewise, our guest is Dov Seidman. Dov's professional career has been focused on how companies and their people can operate in both a principled and profitable way. He's founder and CEO of LRN. Since 1994, LRN has helped hundreds of companies simultaneously navigate complex legal and regulatory environments and foster ethical cultures. He's author of the new book, How? Why How We Do Anything Means Everything. Dov, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
All right. Obvious question. What is how?
We live in a world where what we do matters, but it doesn't matter as much as how we do what we do.
Okay.
We now live in a time where one banker could lose $2 billion for his bank overnight in London and wipe out bonuses for all of his colleagues and send risk reverberating through the financial markets. And at the same time, one vegetable vendor in Tunisia can spark a revolution towards freedom in the Middle East. We are so connected that we have become interconnected and morally and ethically interdependent. The behaviors of any one person can affect so many more and in ways they never could before. We're in the era of behavior. Now, I'm not saying that we need to see behavior as protection from lurching from crisis to crisis or greed to fear.
Right.
Behavior has become the greatest source of our competitive advantage. And our behavior is simply how we do what we do, how we relate to others, how we inspire, how we innovate, how we connect and collaborate with people like ourselves or people halfway across the world that come from different cultures and have different mindsets. If we can harness the power of how, we can create sustainable value and advantage.
Now, in the book, you talk about how principles. What are these?
All behavior is rooted in values. There are two types of values that guide our behavior. The first is situational values. And in many ways, we live in a crisis-ridden world because we've been in the grip of those values. Mm-hmm. We pretty much have gone into the habit of doing whatever the situation allows. We tend to think in terms of what we can and can't do, which makes us in turn think in a short-term matter. In this situation, what can I get away with? What can I get done? And that has not proved to be sustainable.
Right.
The other types of values are how values. They are sustainable values. They literally sustain human relationships. These are deep values such as truth and honesty and integrity and trust and hope. If we can root ourselves in sustainable values and translate those values into behaviors that make a difference, we can, on the one hand, have a bulwark against too much risk and crisis that simultaneously guides and propels us towards advantage and relationships that are not transactional but lasting.
You also write about how we need to apply values more effectively. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. The University of Michigan Health Systems found itself being sued increasingly for medical malpractice. They weren't alone. Other healthcare providers have confronted the same challenge. So these doctors got together and they said, who are we and what are we about? We're in the well-being business, and when we harm patients, we should reconnect with them by apologizing to them earnestly. You can imagine their lawyer said, that's too much risk to say you're sorry. It'll come across like you're admitting guilt. And the doctor said, let's live our values. Well, their lawsuits went down by 50%, as did their payouts, because they translated their value into the behavior of an apology. What's interesting is they became so much more comfortable talking about errors and mistakes that they created a culture around them where they were able to improve deficiencies in their operations and their healthcare outcomes improved. Then they made a wave. 37 states have since passed legislation where an apology cannot be held against you in a court of law. So here's an example of living your values, because that's what you're committed to doing, in a way through your behavior where you achieve advantage.
Now, in the book, you talk about how can help repair even our faltering global economy.
One of the things this crisis has revealed is that somebody selling a mortgage he should not have and someone buying one they should not have could get bundled together in a package of 1,000 such mortgages and bring to its knees a Norwegian pension fund.
Hmm. Right.
We live in an interdependent world and an interdependent economy. And if we disconnect from how and don't get our hows right, we are going to continue to experience global dysfunction. But if we devote ourselves to the right ideas and the right sustainable values, we will have global prosperity. The more interdependent the world gets, the smaller it gets, the more getting how right becomes not just necessary, but becomes our advantage.
Dov, looking at recent events in the news, where could you see this concept of how applied?
There's so much on the news, but obviously protests such as Occupy Wall Street are typically about some sense of injustice or unfairness. There's something about the system where so few people are doing so much better than everybody else. But I think it's something more fundamental.
Hmm.
It's about freedom. In the Middle East, in the Arab Spring, it was freedom from a dictatorship. But here it might be freedom from a system where you can't control your destiny. You don't have the freedom to pursue happiness, your dreams. Some people want freedom from a command and control dictatorial boss, or they want freedom from being put in a box in an org chart where they just need to be a robot that repetitively does the same job. People today want meaning. They want to devote themselves to work that makes a difference.
Absolutely.
What we need to do is not just create freedom from a system that works against us by tearing it down. We need to create freedom to achieve lasting significance and make a contribution. Freedom, too, requires values and principles and a certain type of leadership. That's where we need more of how.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about how versus how much?
If a friend of yours mm-hmm. came to you in crisis and said, I need $20,000 to pay this month's credit card bill, you would not have a how much conversation. You wouldn't say, how about $15,000? You would say, how are you living your life? And how, as your friend, can I help you get back on track? But anytime we do something at scale, we talk about how much. At a national level, we talk about GDP and consumption levels and how many jobs do we create this month. At the organizational level, we talk about how much revenue can we squeeze into this quarter and how much market share can we take this year. And it's not helping us because it makes us want to just become too big to fail, and that has proven to be an unsustainable strategy. Instead, we need to try to become too principled to fail or too good to fail or too valuable to fail. So we have to learn to scale how. One of the things in business is we manage what we measure, and we measure what we think matters. What we measure is a window into what we value and into our values. We continue to be obsessed with measuring how much.
Yeah.
How much revenue, how much profit, how much market share, how much resource.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true.
If we could learn to measure how we do business, how we engender trust in our relationships, how we innovate, then we can start doing how because we've been measuring how.
Now, in the book, you also comment about how providing a unique and sustainable advantage that can't really be copied.
Absolutely. Business is about creating advantage, and the best advantage is the one that can't be copied. The more interconnected the world gets, the more what we do becomes a commodity. It can be copied faster. And you could go anywhere around the world to find any what you do done faster and cheaper someplace else.
Hmm.
How is so varied. How we do what we do, how we behave, how we lead. There's such a rich and broad spectrum of variation that there's an opportunity to stand out and do something uniquely. Now, my family can't copy your family, David.
Mm-hmm.
Your family can't copy my family. The culture of a family is rooted in a unique heritage, a tradition. Think of a company as a very big family, where how it does what it does, its culture, can't be copied.
Right.
Yet we don't tend to work as hard at being systematic about our culture and shaping our culture as we do at every other aspect of our business. We've systematized everything in business, ERP, HRIS, TQM, CRM. Business is great at systematizing. We now need to get as systematic about the human infrastructure, the human operating system of a company, as we have been about every other aspect of business.
And what do today's leaders have to do to change along those lines?
We've studied this. We just released the How Report. We looked at 5,000 employees who work in small and large companies around the world. The bad news is only 4% of employees work in companies that are high trust, high inspiration companies, where the reason they make a decision or take an action is inspiration, where there's so much trust that they take risk that leads to innovation and progress. The good news is those that work in high trust, high inspiration cultures experience much less misconduct, and they experience much more employee loyalty, customer satisfaction, receptivity to new ideas, innovation, and financial performance.
So what should organizations do?
One of the things that's standing in the way is CEOs are 6 times more likely to observe inspiration than the average worker, those people charged with getting the job done, and 8 times more likely to believe that values is the number one reason someone does what he or she does.
Mm-hmm. So what exactly do you suggest?
If we to go to work to engender more trust in our cultures, to inspire people as opposed to just coercing and motivating them through a system of carrots and sticks applied to corporate policies and rules, if we can go on a journey of becoming inspirational leaders who inspire people deeply with beliefs and values and a sense of purpose and a mission, mm-hmm. we can get on the right track.
Right. Is there some advice that you could give about job creation?
Yes. Obviously, we have a jobs crisis, and I hope that our leaders can forge some consensus immediately to get a jobs program going to get some people back to work. But I fear that those jobs that are created as part of such a program could themselves be gone in a year or two.
No kidding.
Sure. We have a greater jobs crisis than the one we think of. We have a careers crisis. Employee engagement scores have never been lower. 7 out of 10 employees are not engaged on the job. 2 out of those are actively disengaged. They are subverting their company. That totals about $300 billion in lost productivity. But think of the innovation and upward spiral of growth that we're losing because people are not inspired to contribute their character and creativity and ideas. And think of the jobs that these people are not creating for their brothers and sisters and neighbors.
Right.
If we can create more inspired work environments and workforces, we will be able to tackle not just the jobs crisis, but the careers crisis.
So we're actually talking about making jobs more interesting or more satisfying.
We need to replace task-based jobs. We need to take people out of organizational boxes and give them a values-based mission, something that will inspire them to contribute fully. I think that's what people want, mm-hmm. and it's possible. And those companies that do really get ahead. I'll tell you a great story.
All right, go ahead.
I landed in Las Vegas not too long ago on a Southwest Airlines flight. The flight attendant got on the loudspeaker right before it was time to deplane and with energy and enthusiasm said, "We've done research at Southwest Airlines that if you cross your seatbelts one over the other, you're going to have good luck at the tables." And we started to laugh, but, you know, we then did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a federal regulation that seatbelts be crossed.
Mm.
Through how she related it to us, she got us to help her comply with a federal regulation. It also turns out that Southwest Airlines turns their planes around faster than their nearest rival by 6 minutes. It would have taken her 6 minutes to do this herself. She inspired us to help her do her job. They have a brand promise, home on time, fun, safe, and no frills, and she authentically connected to that.
Exactly.
Now, I can assure you that there's no rule book at Southwest Airlines that commands her to tell the gambling joke when she lands in Las Vegas. And she doesn't get paid extra to do that. They've created an inspired environment where she could bring this type of creativity. This type of creativity results in operational advantages, and that is a values-based behavior that inspired how she related to her passengers.
Can you elaborate further on some of the results of the How report?
We looked at how governance, the formal policies, rules, leadership structures, and goals of a company, and how the culture of a company, the values and the principles and the norms, and the leadership models work or not to shape organizational and individual behavior.
Very interesting. Could you share some of the findings?
Those companies fell into one of 3 archetypes. One archetype we call blind obedience, rigid hierarchies, top-down management and leadership, a lot of fear and coercion, and people are pretty much expected to just do as they're told. The other archetype was informed acquiescence, where it's a more rational, rules-based system. It's about the pursuit of success, It's not just sticks, but carrots to motivate people. And then the third archetype is self-governance, where people are inspired by a set of values to not just pursue success, but pursue significance, making a difference. And the leadership style is a connect and collaborate, open and transparent one. 3% of companies were in the values-based self-governance category. 54% were in the informed acquiescence category. The rest were in blind obedience.
Right.
We were able to demonstrate that the self-governing companies are outperforming on all performance criteria the other two archetypes in terms of less misconduct, but more importantly, employee loyalty, customer satisfaction, innovation, and financial performance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, there was an earlier edition of this book. How different was it?
The times were different. To me, the book felt timeless 4 years ago as it does today, but the world has changed. I wrote that we had entered the era of behavior, but we didn't just enter the era of behavior recently. We plunged deep into it.
Oh, yes.
In the first edition, I wrote about the largest Ponzi scheme ever at the time, but that was before the epic Madoff betrayal. I wrote about a golfer, David Toms, who got ahead by doing the right thing, and that was before Tiger Woods. And I opened the book with the wave, the spontaneous act of human energy that takes place in stadiums, because I felt that this renewable, powerful force of human energy was going to become the metaphor for leadership in the 21st century, that we would no longer be able to extract performance out of people or exert commanding power over them, that we would have to generate human energy by inspiring them. And even though I felt the wave was the metaphor, we're now seeing waves.
Mm-hmm. For instance?
Occupy Wall Street is the attempt to make a wave, to force a conversation that we need to be having. Same with the Arab Spring.
Mm-hmm.
We've given the individual the power to be a source for good, to make a positive wave, or to be a force for bad and make a negative wave.
Sure.
The more interconnected the world gets, the more we've democratized, the more we need to root ourselves in sustainable values aimed at missions of real significance so that the wave-making power that we all have can be a force for good.
And since you've completed the book, you believe your book is now on the right track?
Yes. We live in a very difficult and painful time. It used to be that we had a crisis or a boom and bust cycle every 20 years. And maybe if you're going to have a boom and bust every 20 years, we don't have the incentive to rethink fundamentals, how we're leading, how we're operating and governing our institutions or our country for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're experiencing is we are lurching from crisis to crisis, not every 20 years, in some cases every 20 days. So people say, we now can't just think of resetting and reforming and rebooting the system. We need to rethink it, to root ourselves in the only thing that will prevent us from lurching crisis to crisis every 20 days. One day is a $2 billion loss for a banker, and another day it's the Greek bond market. The other day the market is schizophrenic for reasons no one understands, and then you have a tsunami, and then you have a Gulf oil spill. When we are having crises this often, there's receptivity to a complete rethink of how we do what we do. So I think I'm experiencing just a ripeness, an open-mindedness that there must be a better and different way.
Now, before we wrap up, do you have any other key points you want to leave our audience with?
I want to underscore what we're asking of people today in the work environment. We used to ask for productivity and speed and efficiency. And if we need hard work out of people, then carrots and sticks in a top-down assembly line environment worked pretty well.
Right.
But we are now asking big things from people. We don't just want their hard work and productivity and speed. We want ideas from them. We want them to connect and collaborate, to innovate, to represent their company honorably on social networks. We're asking for deeply human qualities. And we need to understand that you cannot command someone to have an idea in the next half an hour. You can't command a doctor to be compassionate at a patient's bedside. You can't command a teacher to foster an environment of excitement and curiosity in a classroom. We are asking things of people that cannot be commanded, can't be controlled, and can't be simply coerced or motivated. They can only be inspired. The kind of leadership we're going to need to thrive in the 21st century is going to be inspirational leadership, rooted in sustainable values, that inspires people to be guided by those values towards journeys, not of just short-term success, but long-term significance.
We've been speaking to Dov Seidman, author of the new book, How? Why How We Do Anything Means Everything. Dov, thanks so much for being with us today on Edgewise.
Pleasure, David.
With only an internet connection and a browser, you can tap into AMA's world-class training. The American Management Association is bringing live instructor-led training right to your desktop. AMA's new virtual seminar offering features a live virtual format that is highly interactive and very user-friendly. It's taught by the same expert, world-class faculty that run our classroom sessions, and the high-quality content has been specially engineered to run in an online format. You get real-time online interaction with your course leader and your fellow attendees. You will receive a USB headset so that you can not only listen but talk to your classmates and your instructor. So take advantage of these offerings, enhance your career journey by building your skills, and you don't have to take any time away from the office. For more information about AMA's virtual seminar offering, visit our website at www.amanet.org. We'd love to get your feedback on today's program. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.